Good morning. Welcome back to the program. This weekend, it was reported that movie attendance is at an all-time low. Our interest in politics and politicians couldn't be lower. However, the one area where both attendance and interest continues to explode is the world of sports. In part, it's the clarity of the story, the colorful and volatile and often egotistical personalities, and also a whole new world of sports reporting. Perched atop this field is our guest this morning, John Feinstein. The author of 28 books, most notably Season on the Brink and A Good Walk Spoiled, he's a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition and a regular on ESPN's Sports Reporters. It is my pleasure to welcome John Feinstein back to this program to talk about his newest book, One-on-One, Behind the Scenes with the Greats in the Game. John Feinstein, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeff. Good to talk to you again.
Great to have you back. Do you like athletes? You know, I've had this conversation with guys that cover politics and politicians over time. Given how long you've been doing this, have you come to like athletes as kind of a class of people?
Well, I have problems putting people into that sort of class. I covered politics myself for several years, and I think sports is like any other line of work. There are some good guys, there are some bad guys, there are smart guys, there are dumb guys. I do think that because on the professional level in particular, they make so much money, there are some of them who forget that making money doesn't make you more important than other people because they're constantly told that they are. And I think as a result, when I run into people who have been put on those pedestals, and I've dealt with a lot of them through the years, as you know, and deal with quite a few of them in this book, and they are good guys, in spite of all that, in spite of living in what I call the land of never wrong, I tend to admire them even more for being that way.
The money is an interesting aspect of it, because if one goes back in sports, and you write a little about this, there's a sense that they're not trying to sell anything, that really what counts, what matters, is the performance. But as branding and money and who they are impacts how much money they're going to make, some of that's changed.
There's no question about that. I think Tiger Woods is a great example. There's no doubt about how competitive Tiger Woods is. If he hadn't been that competitive, he couldn't possibly have achieved all that he achieved before the now infamous accident 2 years ago. But that being said, everything Tiger Woods has ever done, dating back to when he was a teenager, was with at least one eye on how does this affect my marketing? How will this affect my ability to get sponsorships? And I would make the case that he's probably worked as hard to try to rehabilitate himself as a corporate spokesman as he has worked at his golf game since the accident in 2009. I think that's kind of a shame because really he should be just focused at this point. He's got plenty of money. He should be focused on trying to get Jack Nicklaus's record and not on whether or not he can convince Rolex to give him a new contract. I use Rolex because they just did give him a new contract.
What impact do you think that's had on athletes and the ones you've talked to over the years, the impact of focusing as much, if not more so sometimes, on marketing as opposed to the game?
You know, that's a very good question, because one of the things I get into in detail in the book is the way access for people like me to athletes and coaches has changed since I first got in the business now more than 30 years ago. I shudder when I say that, but it's true. And what I mean by that is when I was a young reporter at the Washington Post, really getting access to just about anybody, if you were willing to go places and try to find them and work at it a little bit, wasn't all that hard. We had access to the locker rooms all the time, not only after games, but before practices, after practices. I remember the first time I covered a U.S. Open. In tennis, I just showed up the day before the event began. John McEnroe was on a practice court, and when he was done, I walked up, introduced myself to him, and he gave me all the time I wanted. There's no way I could have even gotten to the practice court, much less to McEnroe, in this day and age. I think it's much harder for young reporters coming into the business. And the reason for that, a lot of the reason for that, is what you're talking about, that now everything is done with an eye towards marketing and branding the minute anybody shows the potential to make any money. I mean, there are guys, take a kid like Ricky Fowler, who's a young player on the PGA Tour. Really nice kid, by the way. But Ricky Fowler is a multi-millionaire, and he has never won an event on the PGA Tour. But because he showed great potential, as an amateur, because he's a good-looking kid, because he's willing to wear some outrageous clothes that get the attention of teenagers. He has made millions of dollars without having yet won. Now, I'm not talking about winning a major championship. I'm talking about winning a tournament on the PGA Tour. Well, that affects anybody. And everything is done now with the eye on, well, we can communicate through the website. We can communicate through our commercials. I still remember the first person who said that to me was a guy named Bill Shelton, who back in the 80s and early 90s was Andre Agassi's agent. And when I was working on my tennis book, Agassi was refusing, much like Tiger Woods now, to do any interviews other than the required post-match interview where we come into an interview room for 10 minutes and, you know, give all the cliche answers that athletes have now gotten down pat. And I said to Bill Shelton, doesn't Andre, who makes millions of dollars because the public cares about him, owe more to that public than those 10 minutes of cliched answers? And Bill Shelton looked right at me and said, we reach our public through our commercials. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, he's probably right. And as the years have gone by, he's been proven to be 100% right.
Another side of the same coin is the lack of personal contact in terms of a lot of sports reporters today, bloggers and radio guys and everything else. There isn't that sense of personal relationship that you've developed, for example, and that you write about with so many of these athletes over the years.
Yeah, and again, I wrote about that in One-on-One, because there is a chicken and an egg factor here. I can understand why public figures, whether they be athletes and coaches or politicians or anybody else, get upset with the fact that there are now this whole generation of bloggers who they never meet. There's this whole generation of sports talk radio hosts who they never meet. These guys just sit in a studio and lob bombs at people who they never have to confront. I've always known since I was a young reporter that if I criticized somebody, I expected to be face-to-face with them shortly thereafter. And in fact, I liked that. There are a lot of instances in the book that I talk about where I've been critical of people, and when they approached me and said they were upset, I'd say, good, let's go talk about this. You tell me why you're upset, and I'll tell you why I wrote what I wrote. And more often than not, it would actually lead to a better relationship. I mean, there were some guys who, never wanted to speak to me again, but more often than not, they'd say, okay, I understand why you said that. And sometimes I would say, I understand why you're upset with me, but I've always gone out of my way to say to people, if you're mad at me, let's talk about it. And in fact, my one lengthy meeting with Tiger Woods, which I chronicled years ago, came from Tiger wanting to talk to me about some of the things I had written and said about him, and more specifically about his father.
The other relationship like that you write about is with Jim Valvano, who was a friend, who you criticized, and the relationship had a long and complicated arc up until his death.
It did, and I think that is a very good specific example of the line that all of us in journalism have to be aware of, and the toughest thing about that line is we don't know exactly where it is, where you want to develop a good rapport with somebody. You want to develop their trust so they'll tell you things that they might not tell others. But you also need to know where the line is where you get too close. And with Jim Valvano, again, looking back, I probably did get too close. I would sit in his office with him at 2, 3, 4 in the morning after games, after all his coaches had gone home and all the pizza had been eaten and all the wine or beer had been finished off. And he would lie on his couch, and he would say, what do I want to be when I grow up? Because he'd won the national championship when he was 37 years old at NC State in 1983. And it was one of those extraordinarily dramatic wins. They were an underdog in every game they played. We've all seen the photos of Valvano running around the court looking for someone to hug right after Lorenzo Charles's dunk against Houston. And Jim was a very bright guy who read a lot, who thought about things well beyond basketball. And he felt like, to quote him, he had done coaching when he won the national championship. His goal had always been to cut down the last net, and he did it. He, as he said, he wasn't as driven as a Dean Smith or a Mike Krzyzewski, who wanted to win and then win again and win again and win again. And because of that, he drifted. He he was hosting talk shows and selling blue jeans and being a commentator on games, even during the season when he was a coach. And worked on the CBS Morning News for a while, just wanted to find something else. And because of that, his basketball program slipped. His assistants were basically running it. They brought in some kids they shouldn't have brought in. They got in trouble with the NCAA. They got put on probation, and Jim was forced to resign. And when that happened, as someone who knew that he had not been paying that much attention to his program, I called him on it. And I basically said, you know, that Valvano let this happen. And when he was making excuses, which I thought he was, I said he sounded Nixonian. And he confronted me and said, you know, how could you, of all people, say that about me? And I said, well, Jim, if I had just made excuses for you, they would have been meaningless, you know, because everybody knows that we're friends. And he said, they would have had meaning to me. And that really got me right in the gut, because he was right, and that we had talked for so many hours over a period of years that, in a sense, I owed him. Probably what I should have done, looking back, was I should have started out and said, look, Jim Valvano is my friend. I respect him. I like him. And here's the way I see it. So if you think I'm biased, it's because I am, because we all have biases, Jeff. We just need to be aware of them. The term objective reporting is an oxymoron. Right. There's really no such thing. Everybody has biases. And fortunately for me, after Jim got sick, we did have several chances to talk through letters, through phone calls, and then finally, 5 weeks before he died, he pulled me aside at the last game he ever did for ABC, which was a Duke North Carolina game, and said, look, I owe you an apology, because you were the only one of my friends who was telling me the truth. Everybody else was telling me, you didn't do anything wrong, you didn't do anything wrong. I needed more people to say, yeah, you did screw up a little bit, Jim, and you were the one person doing it. And whether that was true or not, I mean, on an emotional level, that was important to me, because Jim and I had been friends, and as I sat there with him that day, I knew in my gut that that was going to be the last time I saw him, and it was, because he died 5 weeks later.
There's this sense that, and this is part of the same point, that it is the personal relationships, that it is the one-on-one, that to really cover these stories, one has to go there. I mean, your story about right. even going to see John Riggins is a classic example of that.
Yeah, I've always believed, again, when people say, can we talk on the phone, or can we do it nowadays via email or an interview, which I know guys do, that isn't going to work. You need to be in the same room with people. When I go to a PGA Tour event, I do most of my work on Tuesday and Wednesday before the event begins, because that's when you can get the guys in a more casual setting, talk with them on the range, sit down in the locker room with them, maybe have lunch with them, get them away from the golf course perhaps. And that is the way you develop relationships and trust. The John Riggins story was years and years ago when I was the kid at the Washington Post, and he was the star running back for the Redskins, and he held out. He didn't show up at training camp, and he wasn't talking to anybody in the media. And my boss, George Solomon, said, get on a plane and go to his house. Knock on his door. And I think this is where my training as a police reporter at the Post really helped me, because you learn as a police reporter that a lot of times if you call people on the phone, they're either not going to answer or they're going to hang up on you, because if you're a police reporter and you're calling somebody, it's usually not because something good is going on in their life. So you need to go knock on doors. And you remember one of the great scenes in All the President's Men.
The coffee drinking scene.
It was the coffee drinking scene is a classic when you know, he keeps asking for more coffee because that's the way to keep the conversation going. But you remember before that, they show them going from one house to another and having doors slammed in their face time after time after time. And that's part of being a reporter, is understanding that sometimes they are going to slam the door in your face. But the one guy who doesn't is the guy who makes it all worthwhile. And with Riggins, I flew to Lawrence, Kansas. I went to his house. I knocked on the door, and the first thing he told me was to go away. And I said, John, you know, I'm the low guy on the totem pole at the Post. That's why they sent me here. I'm just a kid. If I go back and tell them I got nothing, I'm going to get fired. And Riggins is a pretty good guy. He said, look, come on inside. I'll call your boss and tell him I was a jerk. I wouldn't talk to you. I said, John, I appreciate that, but that's not going to work. But I did let him bring me into the house. And while we were inside, standing in the hallway, I said, John, give me a break. Just tell me, are you going to play this year? What's it going to take to get you into training camp? And he started talking. you know, it's up to Bobby Bethard, who is the general manager. He's got to make the next move. He knows exactly what I wanted. I'm getting older. And he kept talking. And I knew that if I pulled out a notebook, he was going to throw me out of the house. So I kept asking questions, listened as hard as I could, kept asking questions, till finally he threw me out of the house. But I had enough that I went back to my car, wrote down everything I could possibly remember. I wrote the story. I didn't use quotes because obviously I hadn't taken notes, but I paraphrased, which gave you the idea that he wasn't going to play that year, which he didn't. And when the story ran in the Post the next day, several TV reporters who considered Riggins to be friends called and said, why would you not talk to us, but you talked to this stranger who knocked on your door? And John said, well, I thought we were off the record. So one of the guys, Frank Herzog, who did the Redskins on radio for years, really good guy, called me and said, well, John says he thought you were off the record. I said, Frank, do you really think I flew to Lawrence, Kansas because I was personally curious about John Riggins' contract?
It was, I think, your former colleague at the Post, David Marinus, who once said that the first rule of reporting has to be go there.
And he's 100% right. And David and I are still very close friends. I mean, one of the things that I've been so lucky with, Jeff, is the people I've worked with and learned from at the Washington Post. I worked for Woodward. I worked with and for Marinus when they were both right. Metro editors. I worked with Tony Kornheiser and Dave Kindred, just a raft of remarkably smart and talented people. And, you know, before I went off to do the research on Season on the Brink, the two guys I had lunch with were Bob Woodward and David Halberstam, who Woodward set me up to have lunch with. If you can't learn from those two guys about reporting, you can't learn.
What about the impact of more women covering sports and their ability sometimes to try and get more?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that they understood, particularly that first generation, the Leslie Vissers, the Sally Jenkins, the people like that who came along when they were still trying to keep women out of locker rooms. They understood that to be accepted by the athletes and to be accepted by their colleagues, they had to be better. They couldn't just be okay. They had to do more. They had to get more out of people. And they also had to put up with the whispers whenever they broke a story that it was because, you know, they wore a short skirt or something ridiculous like that. Those people did the work they did and are doing the work they do now because they're good. I thank God every day for Title IX. It was one of the best pieces of legislation ever passed in this country. I have two daughters who are growing up with the understanding that any sport they want to play, they can play. That wasn't the case, as you know, Jeff,
mm-hmm.
30, 40 years ago, and even after the bill passed in 1973. And the same is true of sports reporting. It is now a given that women do the same job that men do, and in many, many cases do it far better than the men do it. One of my closest friends in the business is Sally Jenkins, and I don't think there's anybody any better than Sally.
As you said, certainly athletes are always different and as good and bad as there is in any profession or anything. Is there such a thing, though, as a kind of athletic temperament that is somewhat consistent that you have found over the years?
Well, in terms of being competitive and successful at competing, yes, absolutely. I've always said that the great athletes, the truly elite ones, have to have a mean streak in them. That you will never meet somebody who is the best or near the best in their sport unless they don't have some kind of meanness. I mean, just yesterday we saw Tom Brady, you know, yelling right. at his offensive coordinator after an interception. Because he was angry and because he didn't want to accept the fact that they were struggling against a bad team. I mean, there's nobody meaner or more selfish that I've ever met, and I say this as a compliment in terms of a competitor, than Tiger Woods. I mean, Tiger Woods would step on his mother's neck to win a golf tournament. And Jack Nicklaus was that way, and Tom Watson was that way, and McEnroe was that way, and Borg in his own quiet way was that way. When Borg couldn't beat McEnroe anymore, what did he do? He quit. He couldn't deal with the notion that someone was better than him. He said, the heck with this, I'm out of here. It never came back. And I think that the great ones, the really great ones, have that streak of meanness. And the flip side of that is I look at a guy like Davis Love, who I wrote about at length in A Good Walk Spoiled and who's going to be our Ryder Cup captain next year. Davis Love is the nicest guy I've ever met in my life. He defines the word gentleman. And that's why, in my opinion, with all the talent in the world, he's only won one major championship because he's too nice a guy. Years ago, I was in a locker room with him at the Masters, and he was playing that day with Tiger Woods. And he had always struggled to play with Tiger because he got intimidated. And I said to him, kind of half-kiddingly, when you walk on the first tee today, why don't you just walk over to Tiger, point your finger in his face, and say, I'm going to kick your butt today. And David looked at me like I was from Mars. He said, I can't do that. That might make him angry. I said, he's going to try to kill you anyway. Why not try something different? And, of course, he didn't, and Tiger killed him again. So that, to me, is the common thread among the truly great. In terms of how they deal with us, I don't know that there's any one common thread, except for the fact that most of them do see us in an adversarial way. They look at, you know, I can't remember which of Michael Jordan's retirement speeches it was, but one of them he kept saying to the assembled media, I won't have to deal with you guys anymore. Nobody ever got better media than Michael Jordan. I mean, Michael Jordan was treated like a god when he played for the Bulls. And the only, his media, the way the media treated him only started to slip when he kept making these comebacks and came back to play for the Washington Wizards, and then things came out about his personal life. But for the most part, he was treated superbly by the media, but still talked about them as you guys. And I've always tried to get through that generalization. And one of the things I've tried to do is I don't generalize about them, and I hope that in return maybe they won't generalize about me.
But, of course, as you write about, it has gotten so much harder. I mean, less access in the locker room, more of these phony interview room setups, and less of that one-on-one that you talked about before.
Right. That's exactly right. And you know, the story I tell in the book about being in a Denny's at 2 o'clock in the morning with Mike Krzyzewski after the end of his third year at Duke when they lost 109-66 to Virginia, and he was 38-47. And one of the guys with us, his sports information director, famously raised his glass of water and said, here's to forgetting tonight. And Krzyzewski raised his glass of water and said, here's to never blanking forgetting tonight. And, you know, 8 years later when Duke won the national championship, the first thing Krzyzewski said to me on the court when I congratulated him was, we've come a long way from the Denny's, haven't we? Which shows you the kind of person Mike Krzyzewski is, but I would also make the case that in this day and age, a reporter would never have been sitting with Mike Krzyzewski at 2 o'clock in the morning in a Denny's.
Who have you wanted to spend time with over the years that you haven't?
Well, interestingly, I mean, it depends on your definition of time. I mean, I have interviewed Joe Paterno, but never in any detail, and he was somebody I wanted to know better and never got the chance, and of course, you know, there's all sorts of irony associated with this book coming out and me feeling that way at the exact moment of his downfall. The other person I spent a lot of time with and feel I know well, unlike Paterno, who I never knew well, was Dean Smith. And I mentioned in the book that I wanted to do a book with Dean Smith. He was the first person I approached ever about doing a book back in 1982, and we always kidded about the fact that I'm a Duke graduate and he coached at North Carolina all those years, but we had a very good relationship, and I had finally convinced him in 2009 to let me write his biography, which I had felt needed to be done and I had wanted to do for years and years, but very sadly his health is such that it became impossible for me to go forward because I needed hours and hours of interview time with him. I didn't want to do the book with others talking about him. I wanted him to talk about his life, and because he's been dealing with serious memory loss issues, we just couldn't do the book. And if I have a major regret in my career, it's that I didn't get back to Dean sooner.
Is there a difference beyond the distinction in covering the pros versus college, the athletes?
Well, less and less. The line has been blurred more and more. As college athletics has become more and more of a money game, when I hear people talk about the fact that the government shouldn't intervene in the bowl championship series, and I'm generally against government intervening in sports, but the fact is college football is a multi-billion-dollar business. So when people say, well, it's not important enough, I say, really? If a multi-billion-dollar business is being mismanaged and if people are being cheated and it's being run badly by corrupt people, that's not important. I mean, forgetting about wins and losses, it has to do with fairness and the the way the business is being run. But I think the line has been blurred, especially nowadays when in basketball, when many of the best players only stay in college for a year anyway and then jump to the pros. So they're really, when you're dealing with the top teams and the top players on those teams, you're dealing with pros in training. I mean, when the NCAA uses the term student-athlete, I want to throw something at the television because the people who are making the NCAA, the billions of dollars that it makes, are not student-athletes in 90% of the cases. They're pros in training.
John Feinstein, the book is One-on-One, Behind the Scenes with the Greats in the Game. John, it's always wonderful. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
Jeff, the pleasure's mine. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you.